Hello and welcome back to Millennial 8. This is the final stream for this evening and I'm now here with the Prudentialist. So welcome to Millennial. This is your first time on and I've been aware of you for some time, but this is the first time that you've been on Millennial. I apologize for that. It's always a logistical thing every year about what to do and who to have on. But anyway, you're here now. So Thank you, long time
listener, first time, I guess, appearance. I try to remember how long I've been watching. I think it's been at least 4 years I've tuned in and out to Millennial. I discovered Semiagog here, and I think 2018 is when I first found him. So it's been a great place for me to find like-minded individuals. And lo and behold, they become people I interact with and stream with regularly. So it's been a blessing.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. I think Semiagog, he appeared in 2018. I don't think he was on the year before. No, he wasn't. That was a big year, 2018. I think I had a ridiculous number of streams that year, but I can't remember what it was now. Semiagog is a good guy, and I like that this does seem to, Millennial does seem to have this practical effect of making people aware of each other who weren't previously aware of each other. So I like that. I know that quite a few others have met each other through this, ironically. So anyway, why don't you introduce yourself briefly to the audience?
Sure. So I am the Prudentialist. I'm a relative newcomer. I came around towards the end of 2020, sort of inspired by quite a bit of the individuals you've had on previously as guests, the distributist academic agent Morgoth, Semiagog. And when I had started at the current point in time, I had recently moved. Of course, the pandemic aspect of it was in full swing with social distancing, and I was working from home and realized I had a lot of time on my hands and listening to these people talk. I thought, well, why not give it a shot? And lo and behold, I've been blessed to do so. So I am mainly on YouTube, Twitter, and Substack, although you can find me on Telegram, Odyssey, and Rumble as well. But I cover primarily American politics, culture, and I conduct a weekly show on international relations and geopolitics called Prudent Observations every Saturday afternoon at 2:00 in the afternoon Eastern time. And that's what allows me to do most of what I focus on, is on that aspect, which is providing theory, the lectures, the literature, and making that stuff accessible for people to try and get a sense of what's going on in the world.
And that's a handy segue then to ask you, what is going on in the world?
and a bit of everything all at once, I would suppose. It's been a disaster, I think, for trying to cover the day by day of, for instance, the current conflict between really Russia and, by extension, the rest of the Western powers through Ukraine. I've been trying my best to focus on, for instance, like the side impact of that, which, for instance, when I was doing my research talking about the war, I've noticed that there are two companies inside of Ukraine that produce roughly 50-60% of all of the world's semiconductor grade neon that's needed for semiconductor manufacturing, which is only complicated and compounded global supply chains for technology and high end electronics, which also played a huge emphasis on America's policy with, say, the USA Chips Act and their ongoing great power competition with China. I've also put a lot of emphasis that we're going to see a greater focus on Central and South America in the future, especially with the rise of much more Latin American and Central American governments focusing on their own institutions, such as CELAC over the American-led Organization of the American States, the rise of Chinese investment in that part of the world, especially in the lithium triangle with like Peru, Chile, and Argentina. But it's a place where I think even Western think tanks and powers recognize that the globe is heading towards a much more sort of stratified and regionalized aspect of spheres of influence and things like that. But I also try and focus to make sure that there's literature available to the audience. We do plenty of book reviews ranging from, you know, Mackinder to John J. Mearsheimer to What the Chinese Are Thinking. We recently covered Unrestricted Warfare on the channel with a former naval officer and friend of mine, Raging Mandrel, good friend. But yeah, it's primarily what I try to do is to provide some focus on not just the big ticket items of what's going on, because I don't do this full time. So, but it allows me to maybe provide and shed light on other parts of the world that we might be missing out on, such as a civil war in Ethiopia that has been going on for quite some time.
Yeah, I think what you just said there, that we're heading towards a much more stratified world, another way to say it is multipolar. A couple of years ago, I had a conversation with, I can't remember who it was now, but it might even have been on Millennial. And we were reminiscing about the past, as one often does. And perhaps I do it too often, I'm not sure. And I got talking about Home Alone 2, which is set in New York, New York City. And I was saying, I think that was 1992. And I was saying that, you know, back then, I was 11 and, no, hold on a minute, sorry. No, I was 9. And I'd never been to America. I'd certainly never been to New York City. I'd grown up in Scotland. I was in rural Scotland. But I had videos and films and cinema. And America at that point in 1992, you see Kevin McAllister in the big city, the Big Apple, and it's all huge and busy and bustling. You know, America at that time to a child just seemed like the center of the world. It seemed incredibly powerful, incredibly wealthy, upbeat still. I think after the high point of the 80s, that was still there in the early 90s. And it just seemed sort of, I guess, like London would have seemed 100 years earlier, the center of the world. And I guess I would like to hear your thoughts on that, because obviously you are quite a lot younger than me, from a different generation, really. And how you perceived America in your childhood? Did you perceive it in the way I've just described? And how things have developed since then?
I have a rather, I don't want to say rose-colored glasses view of America. Your video on third culture kids actually kind of applies to me rather well. My father was in the military, so most of my idea of America was spent rather abroad and with a bittersweet nostalgia as a grown man nowadays for people like George W. Bush. I have a distinct memory of September 11th and sort of the real shifting point for, I think, a lot of people in the United States, both my age and probably older. To put it in perspective, I just turned 27. Today's my birthday. And
I meant to say happy birthday.
Well, thank you. And, you know, for me, it was that I was recognized two things. One, you know, for instance, like the idea of evil can exist very manifestly and very real in the world with regards to the attacks, regardless of whatever your opinion may be on them. As well as the fact that I moved around a lot, so I got to see different parts of the world. I was very blessed to spend most of my childhood overseas in Germany for about a decade, and getting to see the old world. And we had left and came back to the United States in 2011. So prior to the migrant crisis, prior to really everything that we have seen in the news headlines for decades now, or what feels like decades. But
yes, I often say that the 2000s was a sort of empty decade in a way. Things did happen, and obviously it started with the massive thing of 9/11. But I feel, in a sense, that the world sort of stayed in a kind of stasis for those 10 years, for the 2000s, and then the 2010s was far more social change.
I really do think that the 90s came to an end when social media as we know it kind of first propped up. As soon as the smartphone with the iPhone in 2007 alongside Facebook gaining popularity after 2004, where it wasn't just this way for nerdy Ivy Leaguers to see what their fellow female classmates were doing after class, I think that that really brought the death of what we consider the 90s as a decade culturally, and brought about the 2010s and really had kicked things off from there. But it gave me a really deep appreciation for history and culture. One of the things that always stuck with me as a kid is that we visited the Cologne Cathedral, and right next to the Cologne Cathedral, if anyone's ever been, you'll know right next to it, there's this museum of Roman artifacts and Roman colonization in that part of the world, just in a much different, you know, historical time period prior to when the cathedral was built long, long ago. And so it always reminds me of that saying that in America, 100 years seems like forever, but in Europe, 100 miles seems like it's an impossible distance because, you know, as an American, I can drive 12 hours and I can still be in the same state of Texas. But if I drive 12 hours, I probably have driven through 3 or 4 different countries. And, you know, for me, the United States, I still think that there's quite a bit of it, of course, and the discourse, I think, on the distant right, because there's so much of intermingling between non-Americans and Europeans or those down under in Australia or New Zealand or just even those who aren't in the West with their own commentary. There's always going to be a different perspective. But for me, there are parts of America that are definitely worth salvaging, that are worth fighting for and dying for in the instance. But it holds dear to that old American concept that you can love your people, but you can hate your government. And in this instance, I think it's transformed rather well into that you can love your people, but you can hate the empire. And living in what you would call flyover country, that's been sort of a lot of my writing and focus on, has been these dispatches from the imperial heartland, the very real middle in a Dujuvenelian sense that they'd like to hollow out and replace. And so I think that I grew up watching the fundamental transformation of the country from 9/11 to what it is now in the Great Awakening that came therein in my university days, and just wondering, what did I grow up with? How much of it was true and how much of it wasn't? And I think that the real big political waking moment for me was in high school with the Glenn Greenwald, Edward Snowden, WikiLeaks stuff, because all of a sudden I came to realize that all of the great horrors that I listened to political liberals at the time complained about George W. Bush, their administration was continuing. It was more of the same. And it's a good thing to be aware of when you're a very young man trying to make sense of what your place is in the world. But America is definitely has its own ups and downs. I think they still try and sell the big city as a place to go. But you look at it nowadays, whether it's New York or Philadelphia or Los Angeles, or even in parts of Dallas or Fort Worth, they're having their own problems with homeless encampments. And I can't help but think of the decadence of the 1970s. You know, after the Summer of Love of 68 and 69, we went to the moon, we had Woodstock, and then things go downhill. And I think that we're experiencing something very similar, but it's much more inescapable.
Well, the 70s is it's interesting that you say it that way, that there was a high point with the moon landing and Woodstock, which are obviously very different. They represent different forces there. And then everything sort of fell apart. And of course, for me, my image of America in the 70s is, New York, so Taxi Driver, and these very depressing, New York seemed to be a complete hellhole in the 70s. And then what else? You've got stuff like Star Wars, but then you end it with something like The Shining, which I guess was technically made in and it feels very much like it's between those two decades, The Shining.
Yeah, I always say that I think a very good barometer is the music of the 1970s, because it's trying to emerge from the great sort of shift in culture and production from in the 1960s. And what you get is sort of a really interesting form of documentation of just how bad things were at the time. And I think that a lot of our music nowadays, which is, I think, has a much, much, much more diverse in terms of its independence. People can create their own music and put it out there. But I use Steely Dan as my barometer. It's one of my favorite bands of all time. And I think that they have always been my sort of go-to way of identifying sort of the decadence and decay of the 1970s before you really get this resurgent energy and this corporatization, this rise of synth, which is really pioneered by the Canadian band Rush. And that kind of emerges into the 1980s with a much different energy. But the 70s, I think, is a good way to sort of compare now to today. Because nowadays I see where there's been this wide rise of independent artists and also a lot of like young white men that are doing like their own version of SoundCloud rapping and such. And they're all sort of, decrying about the same issues that we, lament all the time here is more on the right, whether it's for law and order or tradition or the lack of families and the destruction of fatherhood. And they're all trying to express it in their same way, and their popularity and music and so on and so forth. To me, it's very telling that we're entering our own kind of form of decadent degeneration, that we have all of these things available to us in terms of choices, where we've basically reinvented cable packages with streaming services. We've more or less have gone back to reality television with internet blood sports. I think there's a straight line from folks like Phil Donahue and Mortney Downey Jr. to the internet blood sport days of, say, 2016, 2017, or even now. And so I certainly think that we're finding ourselves in an interesting pattern or cycle of history here in America. And I'm cautiously optimistic that we might improve our situation, at least somewhat for like-minded individuals. But at the same time, I do get worried that maybe we won't pull ourselves out of it this time. Things are a little bit too accelerationist for us to put a pause on anything.
You said that the 80s saw a revitalization of things when, as life became more corporate, I think you said corporatized. I definitely agree with that. And, you know, again, in the 70s, obviously corporations were certainly there. And of course, if anyone has seen the film Network, a lot of the future was predicted there. And that was, I think, 76. But by the end of the 80s, clearly the corporations were just a much bigger and more prominent part of life. And that did have a sort of revitalizing effect on things. It did energize life. I'm not going to say culture, because that would be a bit misleading, but certainly things are more upbeat at the end of the 80s than they were at the start of the 80s, for sure. But would you say that that has now, that same force that of corporate America, would you say that it is now in the doldrums, or do you think it's still riding high, or what evolution do you think has taken place there? I would say that it's still riding high, but it's become much darker.
I would say that they're looking towards the, I mean, I think our you had Charlemagne on last year when he made a very good point about what media is very good at today, which is that we masquerade this sort of liberal free market economy. We have it in name only, I think, in a lot of ways here in America. And it's more of a command economy where it's very much a concerted group of individuals, PR officers and CEOs that are willing to more or less engage in speculation to get people on board and on message. He had a good Telegram post a few days ago where he was talking about how all of these news headlines about, you know, the potential value of Twitter since Musk has taken over, and all that they're doing is trying to cause speculation and to get people to not put their money into it or to not make it a profitable company or however it's in regards to its stock value. And it's more or less, well, this is a command economy because he's not being completely on script. He's asking for this, you know, in a very liberal sense, this woke mind virus to be destroyed. But if you decide to go against the grain, then you're still going to be going up against a very real and powerful and wealthy corporate oligarchy that wants to shut you down. And it's in the same way where even when there is, say, backlash, you mentioned nostalgia. And I think that's, you know, this fits in very well when we talk about, say, popular franchises that have to be cannibalized for the sake of either the message or whatever you globo homo, whatever term you want to use. And, you know, they're very open about it, where, you know, earlier they had some woman from Disney talk about their not so secret gay agenda. You know, even the phrase gay agenda, the sort of thing that would be used against, you know, sort of morally minded conservatives from the 1990s or 1980s is now very open and flagrant about it. And I think that they still have an obscene amount of power, despite whether they keep tanking losses at the box office, because they can afford to do it. And that was one of my first videos, was sort of talking about how, like, what woke capital is really about. And woke capital is interested in your children, because it doesn't matter that you, a man that can remember what made Star Wars good, and say, you know, when Return of the Jedi came out, but or really, or even, you know, Lord of the Rings or The Predator or anything that we would consider to be like a good classic action film, for them it's about making sure that the children are exposed to it, and, you know, their parents are into it, they want to pass it on to their kids. And even though you and I might disagree with it, it doesn't matter. It's a way to pit them in that sort of perpetual revolutionary state that you can be empowered, you can do whatever you want. And it applies not just to media, it applies to everything that we consume nowadays. Like, there's a terrible pizza chain here in the United States known as Little Caesars. It markets itself as cheap, hot and ready $5 pizza. And their big marketing break in 2021 was pitting themselves as against, you know, quote unquote, big pizza, these like disgusting corporate overlords that keep making things more and more expensive. And they're just like, well, we're not big pizza. We're Little Caesars. We're sort of the little guy. It's almost as if we're trying to invoke the revolutionary memory of Occupy Wall Street or something. And so it has a way to imprint a revolutionary mind or mindset or spirit on people. And I think that they're interested in your children because that allows them to reproduce and make it more effective for its dissemination.
Oh, for sure. I think you've made an interesting point there about, well, you've made a lot of interesting points, but the one I'm going to pick up on is about how the corporate world has a talent now for, that they've understood that people like the little guy, and in that case, you know, Little Caesars, which actually reminded me of Home Alone with Little Nero's Pizza. Anyway, some of you will get that reference. But they've understood that people like craft beer, homemade stuff, people don't like overtly corporate things. I mean, there's a lot of people who like the more homely and the more, and the underdog and the rare and the special and all that, and the struggling small business. And so you've got this weird thing with Amazon where they interact with small businesses, but always under the, I mean, obviously Amazon is the powerful one in that relationship. But you've also got this thing where large corporations will masquerade as small businesses so as to capitalize on people's revulsion at corporations. It's a very strange thing.
I think it's rather effective advertising on their part. If you can trick the average individual to think that they're buying some locally owned or made product and instead it's owned by some huge conglomerate and you can distract them, or you own even your own competition or another side brand. You see this most prominently, I think, for instance, just as an example, I think it's like the sunglasses brand Oakley's or whatever most sunglasses places are owned more or less by one large organization or one large company, and they manage to get it out the way that they do. But people want to think that there's the illusion of choice or that they're supporting someone locally. And I think that we see that a lot with people trying to sell off the idea that this is going to be something exactly for the little guy, the average person. The American idea of, you know, this is for the masses is still a very valid ticking point. And I think that you combine that nowadays. I mean, I don't watch television really often. I mean, I have my local news station that I'll get for like the weather and some local news where I live. But the commercials sometimes out there are insane, where they're just very mask off trying to nitpick at nostalgia in a very ironic fashion, where there was there's this insurance company, I think it's called like Liberty Mutual or whatever, and they literally had the like 1990s style camcorder to VHS footage, home movie style, about some kid unwrapping a Christmas present, and it's talking about their insurance policy and why it's so good for you. Or they've done others talking about like, oh, you know, young people having a good time, that triggers nostalgic memory. And it's so mask off and saccharine, where it's just like, well, they know what they're doing and they know what the research tells them and they can poke a little fun at it. But That tends to be the case, I think, for a lot of media going forward. I think we've seen that in this age of endless sequels, reboots, and people trying to reframe things for a more modern audience. They recently, I think this year, they did a remake of West Side Story for today's immigrant audience in New York City, and it was just absolutely atrocious. But that tends to be the ongoing trend.
Do you think that America is changing into a different kind of, because I said to you at the start that, you know, 30 years ago America seemed to be the heart of the center of the world and all of that. Do you feel that that's going to continue? Do you feel that that's still the case? Because I'm not actually sure. I think it's you know, my own perspective on this is that is not as much the case now as it was 30 years ago, and I'm not sure it's going to continue.
30 years ago is 1992, and we're getting ourselves off the high of the first, you know, time we battled off Saddam Hussein in Kuwait. The economy was finally beginning to rebound right before it sharply takes a dive and Bill Clinton takes office. But I mean, that at a time where it's sort of the unipolar moment. You had Charles Krauthammer write that famous essay, The Unipolar Moment, I think in 1990 in Foreign Affairs magazine. I mean, it was sort of at the zenith, I think, of its sort of military might, where no one could really particularly challenge it. But I think that, and I know that there are some others out there like Niccolo Soldo that has argued that America's never been stronger than it ever has before. But I think in a lot of ways it still is the sort of center, maybe not in terms of economics, maybe not in terms of, you know, there are other places to say trade. And I know there are others that are trying to get away from, say, what's commonly known as sort of the euro dollar or how it manages its money. But I think that America still has its center and its ability to export culture. This was even something that, for whatever your thoughts are, I mean, Emmanuel Macron was quick to sort of point it out when he was talking about that we don't want to deal with Americanized politics with inside France, because that would only weaponize their ongoing demographics issues as well. And my friend Ernst van Ziel, who works over in AfriForum, is just like, they face the same problems that South Africa's own ethnic tensions are now dealing with a slapdash coat of paint of American racialized, woke, progressive, you know, academia in their own sort of conversations and language around those issues. And I've noticed as of late, and sort of looking back with hindsight, that the foreign policy of the United States tends to focus with a little bit of deterritorialization attached to it. So, for instance, when Obama takes office and we're trying to put sort of a progressive spin for the troop surge and the ongoing actions in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, we've got declassified documents now that says that there was a heavy media spin and focus and stuff that even Glenn Greenwald put out about wanting to give it a focus on women's education. And later on, it'd be things like LGBT rights and whatever you, and all sorts of things that we would roll our eyes at. But this was sort of the marketing shtick that worked for it. I mean, the girls' schools, women education, trying to end things like honor killings and things like that. They sort of took the, you know, Christopher Hitchens style of new atheism and brought it in this way to have a much more progressive spin on it, to where now, you know, the rainbow flag is virtually everywhere. The United States State Department under this administration calls it the progress flag. They wave it everywhere inside their embassies in foreign countries, even where homosexuality is illegal. They even did it inside of the Holy See, and I think they've done it in places in the Middle East as well. So when you can deterritorialize or deracinate populations with, you know, subsidiarized media, whether through, you know, the National Endowment of Democracy, the USAID, the United States State Department, and, you know, start generating English language literature that focuses on sort of American culture or how a Westerner would understand this, you know, country if they had no other resource except that. And I mean, like the Kiev Independent that we've seen since the war had started, that had an emergency, you know, grant given by the European Union's Endowment for Democracy. It kind of tells you that it's really a good way to control an understanding of a narrative from a government sense. And I think that the United States still has, as a sort of rather effective weapon of warfare, that kind of narrative control of Americanizing other places of the world, at least in terms of culture.
Oh, I definitely think that America still has that. One thing I would like to ask you about is your perspective on the travails of Hollywood, because obviously this is relevant to what we were just saying about exporting culture, embedding ideas, injecting ideas into other societies. And one of the key, probably the key way that America did this was with Hollywood movies. But to my mind, Hollywood is in decline, or it's definitely not as central to culture and central to people's lives as it was at the, like, for example, at the end of the 90s or even the middle of the 2000s. And would you like to talk about that?
Sure. I think that Hollywood, in the same way that big cable television stations have lost their power, that it's been far more ubiquitous, because even if you don't like what's on, you know, the silver screen over at your local movie theater, there's always a Netflix original or a Paramount Plus, you know, exclusive, you know, three or four episodes of the season premiere of some big, large television show that opens up like a movie that's always available. I mean, the prevailing, I don't know if you want to all call that as Hollywood, but I mean, I think that it's still rather powerful in the regards that it may not just be what's on in the movie theater, but it can be in Netflix and television shows and so forth. I mean, the nice thing about it is that because there are so many choices, there isn't one big show that captures everybody's attention. I mean, you look at some recent television show that had come to end here in the United States, and you compare it to, say, when the television show MASH ended. That is the most watched television finale, I think, in the history of broadcast TV. Whereas nowadays, you know, you would be lucky if you could get those kind of numbers over the course of maybe 4 or 5 years for a show and total watch views or whatever. And so, but everything kind of is very prevailing in the same sense that people will look for scraps of what's good and maybe look for specific artists or actors or producers and directors. But I think it's still really, really prevalent. I mean, people still want things to watch and things to do. And so people will always find a way to want to be a part of the conversation at work or with their friends or family. So I'm not necessarily sure that it's on the decline.
Well, see, the way I would say, I think you're right about HBO, Netflix, or apparently even Netflix is in trouble. I can't remember the details there, but I'm fairly sure I read that they were in trouble about 6 months ago. But the streaming stuff has obviously been going strong for the last 10 years, five or 10 years. I think television is doing fairly well. There are high-profile TV dramas still. I think specifically Hollywood is not what it was. Now, what I would say about this is in the late 90s, I can remember the Oscars was a big deal, even in Britain. You know, people would be talking about the Oscars, and it would be on the news. It would be, you'd see it on TV even before the actual event, and then the event would be on. You'd see it in the newspapers. There'd be the film magazines, which I used to buy. That's an example. But the Oscars is only like that because it's only high profile because movies were important to people, films, Hollywood movies. And I think that has gone. I mean, Hollywood now seems to be largely just Marvel superhero films. What would you say about that?
I would tell you the same thing I told Frody, I think, on this year's Decameron Film Festival. I really do think that Hollywood had its moment where it kind of wanted to, I don't want to say contain itself or to maybe, it was definitely more masturbatory. I just think about the Oscars moment. I think it was in 2016 or 2017 where they were trying to, they had the big upset over La La Land not winning Best Picture. And then it was that, Moonlight, the gay black movie that I think only the critics watched. I don't remember that ever being a really substantial hit. But, you know, one film was sort of this two, a straight white lead in a sort of love letter, albeit poorly done love letter to Hollywood musicals of yesteryear and trying to tell a rather decent story versus something that I don't think that your average person would ever dare want to pick up and be like, ah, yes, today I want to watch the movie about a homosexual black couple with a drug problem. and, you know, that just sounds like good family fun. And so, you know, but that had been the case. And that was the last time that I really think anyone, I had really remembered anyone really caring about the Oscars until that recent little bit with
Will Smith
and the slap about his wife, despite being openly emasculated as a man about an open marriage or not being good enough for his spouse, Jada Pinkett Smith or whatever. But I think that there's a lot there that I would agree with, that in terms of the Oscars or what Hollywood is up to is not really anything I really cared for. And I mean, the last good film that I watched in theaters was right before the pandemic. It was 1917. And even then I had some historical quips about it, but it was well made. It was excellently shot with its cinematography. I mean, that film and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I think, were the last two good films that I had seen in theaters that I'd quite enjoyed. And I've really just been consuming less and less, and I haven't put much thought into it unless there's some big cultural rage bait that people in our circles are talking about or are actually endorsing, like The Northman.
Oh, The Northman. Yeah, I haven't seen The Northman, but I kind of feel that might have been made by accident. I don't think that they're wanting, because some people had theories about this, that it was I don't know, some sort of way to dog whistle to nationalists, or I mean, I don't find that plausible at all. Yeah, I think it was largely sort of something that slipped through the net and happened by fluke. But yeah, I think you're right that there's been a general decline in all of this, and it's become a sort of, well, I mean, it's become a joke version of itself. And I think that's, I mean, it's maybe you're right that it just has a certain lifespan. But I think also there's technological reasons for this. You know, video games kind of took over from film in people's lives, and certainly young men's lives, and also the internet. I mean, I often wonder how the record industry keeps going because, you know, with the internet.
Oh, I'd imagine a solid state of, you know, hipsters and those that will constantly argue online why it's better to listen to it in vinyl. But, you know, if you go to any mainstream bookstore here, like in America, whether it's like a Books A Million or Barnes & Nobles or a Half-Priced Books, people want to buy records, and whether they listen to them or they just collect them, or it's an ironic thing to put on at parties, I don't know. I have a collection, so I guess I'm part of that crowd of people where I'll occasionally listen to it, or I'll look for rare live recordings and try and keep a little piece of history with me. I have a 2112 album on vinyl that I quite like from Rush that I'll put on from time to time. But with the, I think that there's a lot though that you said about the internet that I think just kind of opens up the conversation to go anywhere, because I think so many people want to create their own stories. I mean, as a younger man, I've been fascinated as of late over the last several years where, for instance, horror films have gone to. I think that nowadays, because almost every social norm or moral moray has been sort of, you know, perversed or violated, people are looking for what really scares them. And so, you know, I was rather surprised, for instance, I think the last good horror film I watched was Don't Breathe. And it was, you know, because the, you know, big bad evil guy in the film is blind. And so it's about, you know, your, how much sound do you make? And it was rather well done and well shot. And because it's, you know, it's so often it's just the usual paint by the numbers formula of some, you know, rather urban couple or suburbanite couple with progressive tendencies inherits, you know, grandma's old house that they never really took care of. They never really looked after her, but somehow they got in the will. Something spooks them and they have to rely on religion. And then, you know, the priest doesn't know what on earth they're doing. So it has to be the plucky, you know, progressive family that manages to pull through with it and win over this cosmic evil entity in the end of it all. And so on the internet, people can sort of create their own types of horrors. And I think that that's why we've seen in a mixture of this generational moment where there are people that can kind of remember growing up as kids, older forms of technology, a pre-internet world or a pre-social media world, and that are constantly interested in what they consume, that, you know, we've seen this rise of, for instance, like analog horror, this sort of, you know, idea of horror being found in older technology, VHS or recordings and things like that. And the most popular one that's out there right now is this one called the Mandela Catalog. And it's sort of what makes it scary isn't just the uncanny valley of sort of the entities that they're talking about, but what makes it terrifying is that it asks the question, what if evil won? And so it sort of transcends the creation story out of the Bible. And it's just like, well, you know, what if God lost and evil is actually what's reigning on this earth and it's been guiding mankind? And that's why things are so terrifying. And I think that that's why for a lot of younger people, that's what they're looking for meaning. They're looking for ideologies or religion or some sort of solution to the great emptiness in their lives. Because I don't think that there's a lot of mainstream examples of good, you know, individuals that can set the example. So what do they get worried about? Well, they go to the metaphysical, they go to the teleological. And I think that that's why I think even the memes of today can sort of talk about, you know, schizo posting or looking for esoteric knowledge on the internet, or even the conversation over psychedelic drugs is just so prominent on the internet, especially with those under 45, I think has just exploded as generations are now coming of age that have existed almost entirely with social media and the internet.
Yeah, there has been a complete pulverization of what you might call the center, the mainstream culture. I mean, this is a difficult thing to discuss because it's a quite it's quite a complicated thing that's happened. The situation is complicated, where on the one hand, everything is now the mainstream, where, you know, goth and whatever, you know, there aren't really subcultures as such anymore. They're not meaningful. So in a way, everything is the mainstream and there isn't really a normie culture anymore. But at the same time, well, there is, there clearly is a normie culture, and there clearly are other things, alternatives, niche things that people get into, perhaps more than ever. I think almost a big cause of uncertainty nowadays is that people don't know what to get, what they should be, what to be into, whether it's religion, culture, ideas, politics. Well, politics, they're very heavily guided towards progressive politics. But then there are people who aren't comfortable with that either. I mean, this is a very... I struggle to characterize the situation because it's like there are multiple things going on at once, where the mainstream culture at the center is at once strengthening and absorbing everything into it, and at the same time falling apart.
Well, this has sort of been what I've talked about sort of ad nauseum throughout 2022 as sort of my year in review has been. In January, I was listening to a video by Ryan Turnipseed called The Zoomers, and he, being very much Gen Z, was identifying some of the issues that he had noticed in his youth, that, you know, more people are sort of just sleeping around and are far more openly sexual in their early and mid-teens, and they don't care about it, and it's sort of just an objectifying thing for both men and women. They look for meaning in politics and religion, where they'll go through all four quadrants of the political compass test in about a year and a half and then not really care and then find something that they can just find to be socially acceptable, which is usually progressivism. And they'll experiment with ideology, sexual orientation, they'll try religion, they'll be a Buddhist for 2 months, and then they'll try and be a Roman Catholic, and then they'll try and be, you know, anything out there that they might find any meaning for them. They burn out, and they feel so lost without anything. And it's sort of a running gag for me, is that really the only progressive role model for straight white men on BreadTube is for that you need to transition. So you have to absolve yourself of your maleness, and even then that's not enough. But I call this phenomenon digital deracination, wherein young men especially, women are just as much affected, but, and I think in our sphere, by nature of it being more political, it tends to be a sausage fest. And where young men are constantly more hammered on about what's going on online and not necessarily what's happening in their own lives and their own families, communities, and culture. You know, Morgoth had this saying, I think, last year on a Christmas party stream, where he's just like, you know, I really don't like it when for some reason people will talk about, you know, a bomb that goes off near Israel, but, you know, I try and talk about what's happening in my local area, like there's crickets. And I think that that's a big disparity, is that the internet sort of has enabled and amplified the Dickensian sense of, like, telescopic sympathy, where we're constantly looking everywhere but ourselves, because it's quite easier to be interested in a society of spectacles than it is to look at, well, what constitutes your culture? What constitutes, you know, what does your family do? Can you name, you know, outside of your parents and maybe one of your grandparents? I mean, we've lost a real sense of familial tradition and piety towards that alongside religion. And in doing so, we are witnessing a generation and future generations as well, where people are really more so defined by their consumer identity and what's considered socially attractive. I mean, it's terrifying when there's Politico articles talking about how by 2030, the LGBTQ voting bloc will be one of the largest in America at like 30%, with the potential to grow, which of course was well outside any sort of statistically observable number of people who would fit within those, you know, categories of populations. And it just shows you that we are so uprooted in our lives, either on our phone screens, that people will constantly want to look towards the online, look towards what's socially acceptable, give into these peer pressures, which in turn just become suicide contagions, whether by content, transitioning, etc., that they are T.S. Eliot's The Hollow Men, and it's we're watching them walk around in real time.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I think the loss of culture, the loss of stability, has meant that, and that's the other thing. You know, as much as the subcultures have sort of fallen away or become meaningless, people have also lost faith in the mainstream culture. I think the only thing left that people do, and I'm talking about normies here, do have faith in is just material. Like, I want to have a job. I want to have money so that I can buy things. And that's about it. I don't really think that, certainly in my own experience in Britain, I don't think that people are much more culturally involved than that. If we're talking about ordinary, average people, it's really just the only thing that they can sort of defend is, well, ironically, consumerism.
Yeah, and this was something that a previous guest, I think, that you had on the other day, Gio Panichetti, he and I run a show together every Thursday. It's called The Digital Archipelago, where we talk about culture, and we both bring our educational backgrounds and sort of just discuss the current goings-on. And this last Thursday, we were talking about materialism, and where really that is the case, is that for the average individual, sort of your normie, that's all that is left is sort of this rootless consumerism that you have to be, as Red Letter Media made fun of it, you know, just consume product and get excited for the next product and get involved in the dialectic behind the product, because that will help push it and help generate discussion and sales and ad revenue about it. And sometimes that fails. I mean, I think rather famously, I think that the studio heads who ever ran that awful Morbius movie saw the memes and thought, well, we'll re-release it and we'll make more money. And it obviously didn't. But that's the nature, I think, for a lot of mainstream culture, especially here in the United States, is just this aspect of consumerism. So unless that you have a deeply held political belief system, whether you're a progressive or in its right wing, that it's going to be very hard for anyone that doesn't really give 2 cents on any of those issues to think anything else. But yeah, that could have been better, but they're going to make another one and maybe that'll be fine. Or maybe this spinoff series will be good. Who knows? And it's a very effective way to control the population. And I mean, even now, when I was thinking about recent films that had came out, you had that Top Gun Maverick film, which was trying to bring back sort of the cultural energy of sort of like the American 1980s and the U.S. military. And I couldn't help but think to myself, well, you know, what is the target? Well, we're trying to bomb a nuclear enrichment facility inside of Iran. And I'm just thinking to myself, really, you know, all this Tom Cruise interfamilial drama and all that, all this because, you know, the Israel lobby said so out of John J. Mearsheimer's book. And it's just for them, though, it's a way to get excited and to feel good about it and whatnot. And it's just it's rather depressing to think about, because if you have an entire population that is rooted in sort of a materialism, it's very hard to shake people out of it. And I mean, I'd always had sort of a politically conservative minded. I went through, I think every young white man in America probably goes through some libertarian phase at least once in his life. And when I had moved out of the city of El Paso about 3 years ago or so, and I moved to where I am now in a much more smaller, rural and whiter part of the country, wow, do you get red-pilled faster by reality than any other sort of media that you might have consumed. And I just had witnessed a population of people that still cared about, you know, what their kids are being taught in school. They offer shelter and aid to those after a tornado might hit or something like that. And that they actually care about people wanting to buy land or move up here and things like that. And it's just like, wow, this part of the world that, you know, everyone laughs at or scoffs at or rolls their eyes at, it still very much exists and it's real and should be defended and protected. And I mean, that was sort of what definitely brought me over to this side of things faster than anything else. And what really shook me out of my own sense of consumerism or materialism was is that I sort of had this double whammy. I had moved, and then, of course, COVID had shortly happened right afterwards, and everyone decided to do the shutdown social distancing thing. So no chance to have a social life or anything like that. And then at the same time, due to a medical condition I might have been dealing with my whole life, I had kidney failure. And so I was dialysis, waiting for a transplant, and dealing with all that mess in the midst of people trying to push vaccines, social distancing, and things like that. And it had really told me that there is way more to life than anything else. And if it took a mid-20s guy literally several brushes with his own mortality to be snapped out of it, it makes you realize that, you know, for the average quote-unquote normie, they'll never come out of it. I mean, and we saw that most often with COVID, where the average individual was willing to do anything and to buy along with anything to save their own lives, because I think the West is inoculated pretty much by its technology, its medicine, its media, its government to sort of deny that death exists. And when that tends to be the case, you'll go along with any quote unquote expert or credentialed class and let it happen. And that sort of becomes the new religion. I mean, there's so many sort of terrible, terrible forms of blasphemy of trying to take, you know, like Orthodox iconography. They've done the St. Javelin thing inside of the war in Ukraine, or they have candles of Catholic saints, and they have it with people like Gretchen Whitmer or Dr. Fauci and things like that. And so it's really terrifying that that kind of consumerism has just become this rather material religion for most people. And that, I think, is one of the bigger things that we have to keep in the back of our heads when looking at, well, where's culture going? Where's the state of the West going? What is Americanization going to look like in the future? And I think we got a taste of it these last couple of years.
Definitely. And then there's a lot that we could say there, but I want to take you back to something that you said a few minutes ago, when you said that when you move to a much more rural area, nothing red pills you faster than that. And then you talked about people basically being kind to each other, cooperating and helping each other out. And you see, I was thinking, what would a liberal say to that? Because they wouldn't say that's getting red pilled. They'd probably say, oh, that's just that's just people being good. That's just people being kind. What's that got to do with politics? What's it got to do with politics?
I mean, it has everything to do with politics. I mean, for instance, when I lived in El Paso, and at the time, my girlfriend and I were living with each other, well, ex-girlfriend, but, you know, she wasn't from the area, and neither was I. I mean, I was only there because of my father's job, and it was just like, well, she's like, well, we should get to know our neighbors and communicate with them. And I'm like, honey, you don't even speak the same language as these people. They look at you with a funny eye. Like, we're just as much a stranger to them as they are to us. And by nature of being so close to the border, it's just the way that it was. And it was just like, that's the essence of the, it's a high trust society. And that's something that liberals just don't seem to understand or comprehend, or more likely that they'll outright deny, because they really don't like it when a bunch of white people can seemingly get along and be happy with one another and make a well-functioning law and order oriented society to have happen. It seems that progressivism is just anathema to civilization as we know it. And to me, the reason why it is political, is not just outside of what I just discussed, is because there's so much more opportunity for people to actually have roots here. And I mean, I'm in an area where my family has been for well over a century, and it's just, you know, there's family, we take care of, like, we have a good genealogy book that we can trace back our times to the, you know, 1066. We can go and talk about what our families had done when they came to the New World and things like that. And it's just like, you can't talk about things like that in a city. You have to be cosmopolitan. You have to be in with the latest bits of conversation about the drama and intrigue of businesses today. And for me, I was always sort of the polite white male conservative that would give the sort of, you know, normie Republican talking point or opinion when asked in polite conversation. And I got really tired of that. And I think it's partially why I started doing a YouTube channel. It was that, well, you know, I might as well find a place to explore these ideas and talk about them further. But, you know, moving out in the country and seeing a place where I can find roots and I can find myself sort of rerouted after decades of being a rootless cosmopolitan, a third culture kid, a military brat, where it was so easy to just compartmentalize things, put it in like a mental or emotional box, and, you know, put it in some mental storage container and not think about it. Well, now I have a chance to really sit down and unpack all of that and understand what it means. And I really realized that, no, society really should be oriented about the duty to, for instance, maintain your civilization, which either means reproduction or to create systems and beliefs and machines or buildings that are going to stand the test of time for your fellow men. And, you know, you don't see that in sort of a more urban center, especially nowadays with how immigration is. I mean, it was a shock to me even when I visited London in 2011 that it wasn't what I had pictured in my head. It was far more like, oh, this is like Dallas. This is like Los Angeles. This is like New York City. It's just much older, but there's so many diverse faces and names. It just kind of threw me off as a kid. And so I'm rambling here.
No, it's fine. It's fine. You weren't rambling. It was quite quite focused. But you know, if we start talking about London, that would be quite a diversion. We could be here all night. And I've got a whole folder of images of London from way back when. So I don't want to get into that. I was contemplating putting some up there on screen while you were talking, but then I thought, best not.
Then we really would be here all night.
But yeah, London is, you know, I like it a lot more than most people do in our circles. I can see the degeneration. I can see it even within my own experience of London. You know, I first moved to London in 2002, and it was bad then, but it's a lot worse now. And so are all of the European cities that, you know, I can remember Europe in the 90s being just white, simply white. And it's you certainly couldn't say that now, which is depressing. You know, I don't want to get into it. Now, everyone knows this already. We've said it 100 times. I don't want to labor the point. But anyway, I think another thing I'd like to ask you about specifically, and we've touched on it several times, is the influence of technology, and specifically the internet. Well, maybe not even specific, maybe other forms of technology, maybe the smartphone, I'm not sure. The influence of technology in disrupting and destroying culture, what would you say about that? I mean, obviously, there is the first thing, which is that everything becomes abundant and therefore sort of worthless and ephemeral. But then there's the other thing, that everything becomes permanent. And so the times and periods don't really happen anymore. It's very strange. And there's more to it still. What's your perspective on this?
Well, I think times and eras certainly still happen on the internet. I mean, throughout your various guests and interviews, I've tried to watch as many as I can, you know, the multiple times you sort of discussed that things aren't on the internet right, politically speaking, for the right. It's not like the 2016, 2017 days. It wasn't the time before the great sort of data and society network map had came out, and then there was the adpocalypse and people started getting kicked out. Things have certainly have changed since then, and I think that we'll probably enter a new era of online politics as well in the coming years, especially now that, depending on what happens in 2024, you know, the years of Trump will become a distant memory for some people politically. But I, you know, Gio and I had on a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about this sort of subject of the internet. There was this woman, she went by Humdog in the 1990s, and she wrote a rather famous essay called Pandora's Vox. And she was concerned that, you know, in sort of a, she was coming at it much more from a leftist perspective, but she says, you know, we've turned ourselves into sort of a genderless society where, you know, everyone thinks that everyone's men online, you know, there are no real women on the internet, that kind of meme. And that we're, in order to constantly keep us attentive to our dramas or what get people to listen to us, we have to turn ourselves into our own means of production. We have to turn ourselves into commodities. And I think that she was rather prophetic in her essay. The only thing that, of course, she didn't get right and she didn't live to see it was is that, well, most of the time we're ruled by algorithm rather than just sort of consumer selection of what's interesting or what's good. Because anytime I watch a Morgoth and Endeavor video, well, what's, you know, on my recommended feed on YouTube is going to be something by, you know, Jordan B. Peterson or The Daily Wire or something like that nowadays, which is just depressing. But it does illustrate that the algorithm really wants you to stay contained in these ways. And even now, in order to get people to pay attention or to seek validation, because we've sort of taken out all meaning to anything teleological, spiritual, religion, etc., and you have these sort of, you know, husks that are now more consumer-oriented that get their validation on these very digital Skinner boxes that are attached to us in our pockets, or they're in our hands at all times, our smartphones. And in doing so, we commodify ourselves. I mean, young women will literally prostitute and pimp themselves out on OnlyFans. Men will go out of their way to do ridiculous things online for clicks, or they'll engage in drama, or Twitter, I think, is a great macrocosm of what people will do in all forms of media and niche ideas. There's going to be a community for everything. And it's also a really great way to watch these communities try and find a way to flourish and do so. I mean, the most I mean, for instance, for progressives, right, you have this disgusting place on Reddit called Egg IRL, and egg is the term that they use to identify people who they think are trans and haven't come out or transitioned yet. And it's a great way to watch what people think about grooming in real time. And whereas, you know, here on the right, we've got our, you know, you have these great big events like Millennial, or even Luke has done his own version of it, you know, Lampster during the Eastertide season. And so I find it to be rather interesting that we've kind of made ourselves into what Debord was sort of warning about. We've turned ourselves into a society of spectacles, except we're all trying to, you know, get a piece of the same pie, which for us on the right is very small. We're all, this is something that the distributist, I thought, pointed out very accurately this year, was that we all are sort of pining for the same sort of consumer base, the same sort of patronage base, because we're primarily middle class. Some of us are upper middle class, but we're all sort of after the same bits of donations and patrons because we're not state sanctioned. You know, we're not ContraPoints that can have a conversation with Hillary Clinton and, you know, watch philosophy to work in coordination with, you know, various governments about the issues of COVID and the vaccine. And in doing so, that's our social ecology is vastly different. And I think that as we enter a different age of the internet, as new platforms will emerge or people start making greater emphasis on alt tech and so on and so forth, I think that we're already entering, for instance, a new sphere of the internet. I think Substack, for whatever problems that people may have with it, we're witnessing the return of the blogosphere days of like the early 2000s. And now everyone and their mother has a Substack and you can pay for them. You can just read them for free and listen to audio and video on those platforms as well. It sort of becomes an all-encompassing way for people to get content out. But what I always tell people when I talk about these issues is that one of the things that I'm really concerned about, especially for people my age and younger, because we're going to be the next generation that has to inherit the current hellhole that is modernity, is that I always want people, when they turn their phones off at night, you know, to look at the face they see in the reflection, that black screen, and ask yourself, are you happy with what you see? Because if you're a miserable, you know, fat bastard, you should probably do something about it, and I would encourage you to do so. But if you're, you know, on your phone moderately, or you don't use Twitter or anything like that, I mean, first of all, God bless you. But I think that that's just a lot of the problems that we're going to face is algorithmic control of societies. That's why I think that the current conversations over AI are going to be interesting in the years and months coming forward, as well as that politically, I think a lot more people are focused on action, or at the very least wanting to meet up in real life. You know, AA calls it basket weaving and such, which I participate in. It's very good to know that there are real life, like-minded people in your area. And at the same time, well, with these new platforms and these new ideas and people trying to be more, I don't want to use the word activist, but be more active in the ways that they want to participate politically, not just online, that we're going to see a new era of sort of a hybridization, I think.
Yeah, I think that's, it does seem to be gradually edging towards that. I mean, I can't help but think about the censorship again, you know, because I know that both BitChute and Odyssey are in pretty serious trouble. I mean, I don't know if Millennial will be, I don't know what Millennial like next year. I really don't know. It might have to be on Telegram. Who knows? Or it might have to be on Rumble. And again, who knows what will happen there? So that's a bit unnerving, because something that I've discovered, and a lot of people have discovered, is when you get deplatformed from one thing, it's extremely difficult to get people to subscribe to you on some other platform. Because they're so habitual, and we all are. You know, this is something that I'm not immune to either. It's a bummer. It's annoying to have to join a new platform, register, and do the whole rigmarole. But that seems to me like a very effective tool for the regime to thwart what we are trying to do and what lots of people are trying. I mean, it's not just us. It's not just the dissident right. It's, I think, in general. I mean, I wonder if that is a way for them to gradually, because we think they're doing this to us for political reasons, and I think undoubtedly they are, but they might also be doing it for reasons of keeping control of culture in general. You know, I can imagine. You know, I remember when crypto channels were being shut down on YouTube, like big ones, big, like loads and loads of subscribers. And I remember thinking, why are they? I mean, that's not, I guess you could say it is political. I think the point I'm making is I can imagine them doing this and transitioning to doing this simply to thwart the growth of alternative cultures and subcultures. So that everyone is just, you know, in the fucking pod, in every sense.
Yeah, the memeable eat the bugs and live in the pod. It doesn't just mean a very physical place that you're going to be living in sort of this, you know, Japanese or Chinese style, you know, micro apartment where it's no bigger than a coffin. But I think that you'll also be stuck in sort of an intellectual and economic one as well. And one of the things that sort of got my attention to this was I was driving to work around 2018, and by happenstance, because at the time I drove a rather old car, I didn't have an aux cord or, you know, Sirius XM radio or whatever. I just had access to my local radio stations, my CD player. And so I had turned on NPR at the time, and they were talking about, you know, Mark Zuckerberg in Facebook/Meta now, talking about wanting to do their own version of a sort of like Facebook digital currency, and that they had all this backing with like Visa and those that were willing to sign in, but the federal government was rather ambivalent about giving them any sort of clear way forward. Because, you know, and when you start talking about money and potential avenues for Americans to be taxed, you definitely want the regime to be involved, not some private company, even if they play in tandem. And that's when I told myself, I said, well, the reason why they're telling Zuckerberg no is because they want to do it themselves. And so, you know, like you had just had that conversation with the previous guest about, you know, central bank digital currencies. That's a part, I think, of the economic pod that we may be living in. And so I do see that being a big part of it. And considering nowadays we are very much ruled by the algorithm. Well, what is the algorithm pushing? I mean, if you're on YouTube, you've probably received at least 100 emails this year about the importance of YouTube Shorts and why we need to compete with TikTok and platforms like that, so we can get people's eyes and attention on that, because 90 seconds or less is that we've addled people's attention spans to, and that's really all the kind of content that they can consume. And even in the same way here, like I think the age of sort of the right-wing video essay has transitioned more because people want to watch live streams, and I think that has a lot to do with sort of the forces that push things like Twitch or internet, even internet blood sports and things like that, debates. And so I do think that that's, I would agree with you. I think that the regime is looking for ways to keep you in the pod, and it's going to be not just real estate.
Yeah, indeed. I think the once they've got everyone onto a small number of platforms like YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, then that's it. You know, you can control those platforms, and you've got most of the consuming public, most of the Western public under control. So then you don't want other platforms to emerge that could muddy that. And I hope that BitChute and Odyssey survive, but I suspect they're, well, in the case of BitChute, they're going after their bank accounts have been frozen. In the case of Odyssey, the SEC is going after them for, I don't know, some malpractice to do with the crypto trading. So all of this could be gone. I mean, it is a real concern for me. And I will just have to see what can be done at the time. You know, when the next millennial rolls around, I'll just have to see what is feasible. As I say, I wouldn't be surprised if it has to be entirely on Telegram. I mean, this year it isn't on Telegram at all. I'm not broadcasting it there, but I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. And in fact, for that reason, I would suggest that people might want to join Telegram. You know, the sooner the better. Rumble, someone's just, Geo's just asked about Rumble. I don't know about Rumble. I've got an account on there. I got the ID just so that no one else could take it. So yeah, we'll see. Again, once you've this is the thing. You might find that Rumble bans us all as well. I don't know. I mean, DLive did.
Yeah, I don't know what the future may hold in regards to this. I will say, I think anyone that sort of made an account or made a their online persona or profile after 2019 or 2018. You know, we owe folks like you a great debt of gratitude because we sort of now know what the environment and the ecosystem is. I mean, it's, I find it hard. I don't think I go out of my way and say anything ridiculous in regards to calls for anything that would violate the law in terms of here in the United States. But, you know, I'm very open about things like, well, like the great replacement's happening. These people, you know, they want you dead and they'll take your kids if that's the case. And, you know, but, you know, I can get away with that nowadays and it's monetized and it's odd. But the environment has changed. But everyone I've met who's been banned or kicked off, whether it's you or Endeavor or Morgoth or the Iconoclast, and it's just like all of you guys are the forerunners to tell everyone else who's came after you, you know, this is what they can do to you. And this is why you need to, if you're going to start anything in 2022, then you need to open up all of the necessary alternate means of having an online presence, which means Telegram, Twitter, Gab, Post, Vote, whatever, alongside your Rumble, Odyssey, BitChute, YouTube, and any other sort of platforming system that might be out there for you. I mean, you're not going to get them all, but that's the case. And some places, of course, will just straight outright kick you. I remember, I think it was American Krogan that had been kicked off of Linktree. And so the response to that was this wonderful service by Charlemagne, who had created findmyfriends.net, FRENS.net. And it's sort of a, you know, dissident right link tree for virtually every person that you have ever consumed is probably on there. Everyone from Academic Agent, I think you're on there, Mr. Woes. If yes. not, then I'm sure you'll be added. To Zurius Music. I mean, almost everyone that's been kicked off has got their findmyfriends.net link. So there's an easy place for people to find where they've gone and where they've been. But yeah, I'd imagine that because we do live in this very high pressure, selective ecosystem where we can be notched the next day, then you need to have your backup somewhere and you need to let people know where you exist ahead of time and don't take your presence on there for granted. Because I mean, it was a rough transition to see people like, you know, Stefan Molyneux and Dave Cullen get knocked off YouTube early in 2020, and to, you know, habitually get myself to follow Dave on, you know, Odyssey, and to make a Telegram channel to follow people that I had liked, because, you know, they went after people, I think, harder during COVID than they had done any time during the Trump administration prior.
Well, yeah, I think it was actually early or mid 2021. When Dave Cullen got banned from YouTube, I'm not sure now, but it was sometime like that. Maybe I'm misremembering, but yeah, it doesn't really matter. It is a thing, and you want people to. This is the thing, you know. When I started, it was YouTube. I didn't even have a Twitter, and I didn't start the Twitter until about 4 or 5 months in to the channel. That was a different platform, and back then you could gradually, but definitely you could do it, build up a following on one platform alone. And actually, I remember Dave Cullen, it must have been in 2017, and there was this, the censorship purges on, certainly hadn't started on YouTube yet, but it was on the cards. There must have been foreshadowings of it. And I remember him making a video then saying, in the future, and he didn't realize how soon he was talking about. In the future, it won't be that you just put your videos out on one platform. It will be you've got to put them out on like 5 different platforms. The trouble with that is that then your audience is segmented. It's you know, dispersed. And that's actually why I didn't broadcast Millennial this year on Telegram. Because I thought it's better if everyone, because then the live chat won't be as busy. It won't be as up. Yeah, there won't be as good an atmosphere if people are spread around different platforms. So that was prescient of Dave. Yeah, that would have been 2018 when he said that, early 2018. And it definitely has come to pass. But it's far from ideal. And I think the main thing is that ultimately all of these are niche platforms, with the exception of the obvious ones. And if you're not on those obvious ones, it is a very different life and a very different job that you've got.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that Gio and I had spoken about, is that when we see people get kicked off Twitter or YouTube, people in the mainstream, or that are still on the mainstream platforms, I should say, they talk about them as if they had died. You know, oh, we hope that he's doing okay. We hope that he's in a better place. We hope that he respawns and comes back soon.
Yeah. Yes, it's bizarre.
But I think that does have a lot to say, though, with our conversation about sort of the internet is that, you know, the humanity behind a person, an account, a Twitter poster, or even a person who runs a YouTube channel, anonymous or otherwise, you know, we only seem to manage to think about their existence solely digitally, not that there's a human being behind the screen or the camera or so on. And I think that that's a great factor that we have to think about culturally is that it's so easy to dehumanize more than ever, and even in ways that aren't explicitly deliberate, but rather these sort of nudging ways in regards to, oh, well, you know, it's just a Twitter account. You know, I can follow other people. It's no big deal. Hope he comes back. Maybe he'll make a sock account. You know, it's never the same. You have to rebuild your following. You got to make do. But it's like life. You have to recognize you're on borrowed time, and to remind yourself the ignorance of your time of death, or in this instance, your time of getting banned.
Yeah, indeed. Hold on a second. There have been some super chats. This is from Black Pigeon Pilled. Is the Prudentialist a descendant of the Mayflower? And can he proffer his thoughts on the current state of wasps in contemporary America?
Not the Mayflower, but the third ship that had came on over from jolly old England, my mother's side, can. But it was funny, we were just having this conversation on my, I had a stream on YouTube, a little birthday hangout with some friends, and we were talking about wasps in America, where even for what we would consider white, right, you know, just European ancestry here in America that are white presenting, is that, you know, the largest number of European ancestry in terms of that outnumber the wasp is actually Germans. And that that's an interesting thing to just keep in mind when we sort of discuss it. But in regards to wasp, it really does seem that sort of the New England stock that really maintains a lot of the cultural powerhouse, at least up there and close towards DC and Nova, you know, has no problem getting along with sort of immigrant classes that come on in to get the regime to where it's going. But at the same time, there are plenty of other wasps that have watched their institutions been carved out from the inside for this progressive mind virus, where other wasps have been very concerned that their Episcopal churches, for example, like why is there drag queens going on during, you know, an Episcopal or an Anglican liturgy here in the United States? It's just an absolute outrage. But they've seemingly have gone quite along with where the progressive domineering has led us towards. And I get concerned about that. But at the same time, for a lot of them, too, they are just as equally deracinated and uprooted from any style of, you know, Anglo-conservative culture that may have existed, you know, 120 years ago or even earlier prior to it. And, you know, as a WASPy guy myself, it's very difficult sometimes for me to, like, recognize that there is culture and that there are things that matter. You know, I live in a place where not too long ago there was a great deal of hangings during the Civil War for suspected Union supporters. My family fought in the Red River campaign. My father's side of the family came from the North and fought for the Union. It's just, it's a difficult thing to sometimes realize is that for as young as America is, there is still a deep-rooted sense of culture. And for a lot of wasps, you just go on board with what's socially acceptable, or you're just totally mindless of any terms of culture or history that your family lineage may bring about.
Yeah, I think that it's one thing to be a wasp, and this applies to any culture, any group of people. It's one thing to be the thing, but if you don't know the culture that has been associated with that thing in the past, or if that culture is now seen as passé, then it's very difficult to go out into the world with any pride and enact that archetype, as it were. You might as well just find something else. You might as well just be nothing. You might as well just be a default human being. You might as well just be mainstream. You might as well just be what everyone else is. And I think the denigration of the WASP, I mean, even the word, is the acronym, is it's not the most pleasant.
It's dehumanizing.
Yeah, and it sounds, well, it sounds nasty. It sounds like something that stings you, for heaven's sake. And I know that that's not the all there is to it, but it, yeah, it's an unfortunate acronym. The denigration of the WASP in, you know, Hollywood, we don't need to go into that, I think has, and just in general popular culture, has resulted in this. And a similar thing in Britain. I'm sure it's probably the same all over Western Europe as well. The native, or what used to be in the group that was in charge, and what was seen as the main group in that society, the group that had prestige in that society. In each case, it has been denigrated. I mean, in Sweden, they don't even recognize that they exist. You know, the Swedes don't recognize that there is such a thing as a Swede, that there is no such thing as Swedish culture. Indeed, I remember, actually, I did a video about this back at the start, because I realized that I had seen the phrase, let me see if I can find the video now. But basically, it was this claim that there is no such thing as X culture. And I realized I'd seen it said about the Britain, England, Germany, Sweden. And so I started Googling, and I realized you can find it everywhere. Whatever culture you're talking about, there is someone who has at some point said that culture doesn't exist. There is no such thing as French culture. There's no such thing as Italian culture.
Yeah, I mean, in America, it's more catch-all. There's no such thing as white culture, almost as if, you know, the country, yes, that built this place didn't have a culture or an ethnic identity or a religious identity. As nice as it would be to go back to the Immigration Act of 1790, you know, that's the sort of real American cultural exposition of who they wanted in this country to begin with. But yeah, it's been a great form of just sort of atomizing people to where there is no sense of culture or identity. And they even, I mean, there are people that will comment, for instance, even on sort of normie niche hobbies, you know, like Civil War or even British reenactors for, you know, using old style gear and the weapons of the 1700s and 1800s. And they're like, well, this seems a little too white nationalist for my taste. And it's just like, these people have culture. This was part of what made them who they are, you know. And alas, this is the sad state of affairs, both in any Western country, both here in the US and elsewhere.
Yeah. There's somebody has said, Stephen has said, I'm actually not confident that German DNA is a higher percentage than WASP or British DNA in America. Keep in mind that self-reporting of British ethnicity changed to American for very many in the late 20th century. And so solely German self-reported status is more common now. So British ancestry people started just referring to themselves as American.
Well, that's a good point. I didn't consider that in my review of census data and whatnot, but that's a good point to consider.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this has been a very interesting conversation. I feel like there's a lot more that we could talk about, but I am beginning to get tired, so I don't want to serve you badly. Is there anything else you'd like to say about the issues that we have discussed?
I do think, just to sort of maybe put a pin and perhaps have you on one of these days to sort of discuss them further, is that I think that in our discussion of the culture war, we have to realize that we're not just culturally, but in all forms of politics that we participate in, is that we're in a very real war of images. I mean, we communicate very mimetically, for instance, on Twitter or Telegram. It's a great way to get ideas out. And at the same time, we have to consider, well, what's within the macro or where are the sources for these things. And it becomes very easy sometimes to quote and pull from Unrestricted Warfare by the Chinese in 1999, that even individuals that share news headlines or articles or images can unwittingly become participants in a non-battle space that is part of a greater conflict. And I think that that's something that we should consider going forward when it comes to algorithms or our identities online. What do we do? And one of the things that I've done, I didn't do it today just because I didn't get the chance to get dressed for it in my usual suit and tie, but you know, showing some humanity to it. I'm not going to denigrate anonymity. I interact more with anons than I do people who show their face, but I think we do have to do more to humanize ourselves in the future, because if not, we'll just be as equal participants as a lot of mainstream culture, where we just dehumanize ourselves to where, oh, you know, maybe they'll be back. Oh, that's it. I hope that they're in a better place, not realizing that that could be a real human being with friends and family and need to do so. And if the one last thing, if I will plug, is that you've had a few other American guests on, including Paul Fahrenheit and Jay Burden, that we are members of an organization that we started this year known as the Old Glory Club. This is meant to have a focus explicitly on sort of that white American history and culture and where we get our roots from, especially in sort of an Anglo tradition. And that will be used in the future to fund mutual aid projects in the future. Today, we had just recently covered the Christmas Truce of 1914, but also the Christmas Truce of 1862 in the American Civil War. So that is an organization that if you're interested in, it will be, you can find us on Substack, Twitter, and YouTube, as well as Rumble and Odyssey. But that organization is a listed business for us to go forward and support Americans that need really anything, whether they've been doxxed and need some cover, affected by a fire or natural disaster. But we want to do more that isn't just online, and that means helping our fellow men out.
That sounds great, and I wish you luck with that. I am aware of it, but I wasn't aware of quite the extent of it. I just thought it was a stream that you did together. So I'm very glad to hear that there's more to it than that, and it sounds very worthy. There is one other question from One-Eyed Fat Man, and I guess he must have posted this quite early in the stream, so I apologize. Talking of the 90s, the gay flag may have been flying in more liberal places, but it certainly wasn't the rainbow flag of 2022. What on earth kinds of forces has final say when a symbol like this changes? I'm not quite sure what you're asking. I think he means that the in the 90s it was just the gay flag. It was just the rainbow thing, and now it's got the what is it? I've forgotten what that.
Oh, I just used the one from the Microsoft put out during one of those various Pride months where it just had everything and it looked like a vortex going into everything.
Oh, I saw that. I saw that.
I really do think that that's just the purest example of what Soren Kierkegaard wrote when he discussed the concept of the leveling, that all individuality, all aspect of culture would be leveled and flattened down into nothing, and people would literally turn into, like, you know, he was coming at it from a more Christian perspective of what would be considered Nietzsche's last man. But in this instance, in 2022, the leveling is just everyone has to be fake and gay.
Yeah. I mean, it's a thing. You know, I saw Justin Trudeau talking about this a month ago, and it was the thing where he appeared on some show with a bunch of drag queens and something like that. And he was saying, well, we have to get away from tolerating and we have to start celebrating this. And I remember also during Pride Month earlier in the year, he was saying the same thing. He was saying, in fact, I think I've got the clip. Hold on a minute. Why not? We'll have a cameo from Justin Trudeau. Oh, God, I'm not sure if I can find it.
He did an awful video earlier today with his transportation minister saying that Santa Claus was allowed into Canadian airspace. And so I guess they gave him the vax pass or something. But Santa needs to avoid seeking Canadian health care. That's for sure.
Yes, definitely. I can't find it. That's a shame. But, well, I mean, that's really annoying, actually. I was hoping to show you because it would have been funny. But no, going back to... No, let me see. It's going to be... Yeah, it could take ages to find this. No, I think I will... Yeah. Anyway, the point was he was saying that it's something that it's great to see everyone out together celebrating. And I thought, well, what are you? You're celebrating. I mean, it's gay pride. It's or whatever they call it now, LGBT pride. And you know, first of all, it's. I mean, you don't want that for the mainstream. You don't want that everyone getting into that and that being promoted. But secondly, what are you even celebrating? That people do different things in bed. I mean, it's just absurd. It's a silly thing to talk about, to celebrate. As I say, I wish I could find it because it'd be so funny to have that imbecile making a cameo on Millennial, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, before we went on the air, we were sort of pondering what we might discuss, and I know that you're the interviewer, but if I could ask you a question, since we discussed the year in review, has there been an appearance video, a gram of woes that you've done that you've been most happy with that people should see in 2022?
Oh, there were a few towards the end there that I thought were good. I was more pleased with the gram format last year. This year, I have to say, and I sort of apologize. I want to apologize to people for that. I took a long time to get them up on Odyssey. It's because other things got in the way. There were also my computer problems that started happening, but that wasn't the main problem. The main problem was I started doing creative writing, and I got really into that and I loved it. And then each of the grams was taking like 2 days, 3 days to edit. It was kind of ridiculous. Now, I think it was worth putting in that amount of work for each one of them when it was discussing something like the COVID stuff last year, the whole World Economic Forum. And I quite enjoyed doing it then. But this year, I really felt like it was a bit onerous. Next year, I think I'm just going to put up the raw files. I might not even do the topic headings. I'm not sure, because I don't think people really care about that. So if they don't, then it's not worth me putting in the time to do it. But yeah, having said all of that, I do think that the several towards the end were good. There was one where I talked about probably the Nord Stream one, whenever that was. I think that would have, I guess it would be the start of October, whenever it was that just happened. The first one after that, I thought was, I was quite indignant. And I liked that one. I was pleased with that one. And also the one about the Queen's death was quite pleased with that as well. There was also one that was pretty much dominated by Rishi Sunak becoming Prime Minister, but that's, it was all right, but I don't think there'd be much surprising in there. There was another one towards the end where I talked about rebellion and Extinction Rebellion, linked that with 1970s punk and the idea of being an outsider, the idea of, and the idea of astroturfing. So it's all fake. Because I find that very interesting. And of course, there's the question that maybe it was always fake, that subculture, like hippies and all that, it was always astroturfed. So what we think of as rebellion has actually always been something put on by the powerful. So when we mock Extinction Rebellion now, that is often done from a place of some naivety, I think. That was a good one. I'm trying to see if I can find the specific episode where that one happened. It was Extinction. Yeah, it was the AstroTurf Rebellion. That was on the week 44, which was the 31st of October, Halloween, I guess. That would probably be my favorite gram from this year. So thank you for asking that.
Well, thank you for having me on. I greatly appreciate it.
Okay. All right. Well, I will be... Let me see if there are any... No, there aren't any others. Tomorrow I will be back with, three interview streams and then the Christmas cards stream, which will be a new thing. We'll see how that goes. That will be... So the streams will be Emma Lucy Shaw, then JF Garipi, then Auntie Dem, and then the Christmas card stream. And that will be the final night of Millennial, the sort of main body of streams. So, I kind of regret it. It's come up very quickly, suddenly. I was sort of in the middle of it. It's drawing to a close. But, I mean, beyond that, there will also be the Christmas Day AMA, the Boxing Day AMA, then the Academic Agent stream, and then the Morgoth stream, and then the outro AME. So there's quite a lot of material still to come, but the main body of it is, the last night of that is tomorrow night. So I hope many people join.
Well, we've been promoting it nonstop over on Telegram, so I'm sure people will.
Well, thank you very much. And hopefully I'll also have the NFT ready for tomorrow. So that's something I wish I'd got done earlier. That's something I do regret, that because last year the NFT was quite a big part of Millennial, but this year there were just so many problems beforehand that I didn't have time to get that ready for the start of it. So I've been working on it throughout Millennial, so it will hopefully go up tomorrow, and I hope that some people bid on it, and someone owns it as they own the 2021 NFT. Okay, so that's what's to come. In the meantime, the Prudentialist, thank you for appearing on Millennial 8.
Well, thank you so much. I look forward to speaking with you again sometime in the future.
Certainly, certainly. Well, thank you, and I'll see all of you tomorrow night. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. T-shirts and mugs and other wondrous gifts are available in the merchandise store. Impress your family, friends, colleagues, and business partners with these incredible items. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.